Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Welcome you into the Tuesday edition of the WGTD Morning Show. Dave McGrath, still here. I must pass on some bad news to you. Greg Berg is sick today, so I will be filling in on the morning show today. And we welcome into our studios the director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, a regular visit to the WGTD Morning Show. This is Professor Art Serb. Art, thank you for being here, and thanks for putting up with me today.
Well, good morning, Dave. Very nice to be with you.
All right. We are going to discuss, as Gregory always does, with Art, current events, things going on in the news, both here locally, nationally, and throughout the country. And I thought we would start off today with the death over the weekend of Nancy Reagan. Obviously, she and her husband, President Ronald Reagan, icons in conservative politics. Your remembrances of, because I think in the foggy days now, 30 years past, people forget her role in the Reagan administration. Could you remind us?
Yes, indeed. First, let me mention before I forget, I really want to thank you and Dave Cole, the station manager, for coming over to Carthage for a special event in our library honoring our friend Greg Berg. Our president, Greg Woodward, had some particularly effective and heartfelt remarks, I thought.
He did.
Delivered with his characteristic energy and enthusiasm, and it was really great. And Carol Sabar and Todd Kelly and others from the library staff made it really worthwhile. We have a very prominent exhibit in the library lobby of, as you come in, of books that have been discussed on this very fine program. And it's not a plug for Carthage or for WGTD. It is a plug for our library, which people ought to visit. But I really was impressed and quite moved by the event.
And during that event, talking about Greg Berg, the word annoying came up quite often, did it not?
That was President Woodward, yes. Speaking ironically,
yes,
but, you know, Greg is in important ways an impossible act to emulate.
True.
So there's no need for you to apologize or me. But I really thought it was a great tribute to him. But they also, including President Woodward, captured his distinctive personality quite effectively. Made my day and week.
Yeah. And Carol Sabar gets most of the credit for putting that together.
Yes, indeed. A language teacher who also writes a tech column for the Kenosha News and is that rare individual who understands computer technology but can also explain the matters in plain English.
To knuckleheads like me, right.
Yes, well, that makes two of us. On to the Reagans.
Nancy Reagan, yeah. Would you consider it a controversial role she had in her husband's administration?
Yes, she by her own choosing, she was a very prominent person. Unlike Rosalind Carter and Mrs. Clinton, as far as I know, she did not attend cabinet meetings and assume the role of partner president or whatever it was. But she was quite prominent in the media, and her rather expensive tastes and also her very powerful loyalty to her husband, which was expressed at times in allegedly removing people from office, she had a very influential role. She was also very loyal to him, and once again confirming that the passage of time tends to reconfirm our better instincts and the better angels of our nature, as Lincoln used to say. I'm very glad that the commentary about her has been so gracious.
A lot of it has. A lot of it has. Some of it has centered on, as you duly noted, her expensive taste. And as I was reading some of the stories in the newspaper about Nancy Reagan, was she fairly criticized or unfairly criticized for how she redid the White House? Because I read she got a lot of that money from donated.
Yeah.
And as we know in politics, the expectation is if you donate, then you know there's a quid pro quo. So was she fairly or unfairly criticized for that?
Oh, politics is unfair and life is unfair, as President Kennedy used to say, and so I'm sure a lot of it was unfair. The Kennedys, Jacqueline Kennedy, got a lot of very positive press for doing much the same thing.
Because?
Because
why?
It was a more innocent time. We had more respect for authority, and we weren't nearly as cynical, I believe. And after the monotony of the Eisenhower years, I think that kind of change had a particularly dramatic impact. That was all to the good.
Sure. Well, then the Reagans came in after the very low-key Carter administration, and is that not an pretty much the same as the Kennedys coming in after the Eisenhower?
In a way.
Wasn't it due for refurbishing?
I believe that was certainly true in the 60s. I'm afraid I'm not an expert on White House decor. I do know something about the architecture. And you're right, we elect presidents because they appeal to us in contrast to their predecessors. Eisenhower was not a do-nothing president. I think he was the greatest president since the Second World War, and increasingly opinion is coming around to that point of view. In academic opinion, the people always loved Ike. And the sense of energy and elan that came with the Kennedy administration was a great contrast to that. And it helped JFK come from out of nowhere and get elected in 1960. Likewise, President Carter, fairly or unfairly, was seen as someone who was beleaguered, overcome by events. To some extent, that's true. I don't believe he was a great crisis manager. And Reagan, like JFK in 60, projected an image of strength and toughness that was very persuasive for the people.
Then with that image of strength and toughness, and this has always been the dichotomy for me, because he did have that image, and yet here's Nancy Reagan always painted as his protector, and we know she was an advisor, but painted in that role as a protector of Ronnie. I don't get that dichotomy.
Well, every intimate relationship is complex. Eleanor Roosevelt, it's certainly no secret nowadays that she and President Roosevelt had a complicated personal relationship, to put the matter mildly. She was in many ways more trusted by the people at large and more influential in human terms than he was. Again, the people aren't stupid. But her tremendous, unprecedented influence with the American people and with leaders in Washington essentially reinforced his role during terrible, much more difficult times than anything we faced recently. I was around President Reagan twice. The second time, Illinois, before Super Tuesday came in the 80s, Illinois had an often pivotal primary, and he and his wife, he delivered the one foreign policy speech of his campaign in 80 at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, my employer at the time, and we had an opportunity, our president, John Riley, and I, to spend about an hour with Governor Reagan and Nancy Reagan over lunch before a speech, quite unusual for a presidential candidate. And I was impressed by his very authentic quality. He really was a very engaging human being close up. I used to tell our staff, we ran literally a couple hundred meetings a year at this organization, and VIPs and senior people from the U.S. and elsewhere were a regular staple, and I would remind colleagues on the staff and myself that, remember, in this business we deal with the great, the near great, and the in great. Reagan was really quite attractive as a person.
Is it your sense that, and we'll move on to current events here shortly, is it your sense, Art, that...
History is important, especially nowadays, buddy.
Yeah. Is it your sense that President Reagan's legacy is he becoming more beloved as all of us get older in the tooth? I remember back in the latter days of his administration, he was mocked as being, falling asleep in cabinet meetings. I don't know if that was true or not, but that was, you know, some of the scuttlebutt going on. And he really was checked out on a lot of things. Is his legacy becoming more and more beloved in this country?
Yeah, he's become an iconic figure, I think partly because of the attractiveness I mentioned. Tom Clawson, for whom our Clawson Center at Carthage is named, was a Carter nominee, actually, to be president of the World Bank, but he served during the Reagan administration. He had been CEO of Bank of America, and based in California, of course. He knew, therefore, Governor Reagan of California fairly well. And he told me more than once that the main thing about Reagan is he made us feel good about ourselves one last time, which, as is often the case with Tom, I thought was extremely insightful. The symbolic role of the presidency is not to be underestimated. Reagan and Mrs. Reagan had this time because, first of all, he was able to follow a fairly relaxed schedule, and he was an older person, but also John Connally had dropped out just before they came. A light bulb went on over my head. We kept our budget balanced and growing in real terms, which was not easy through the 70s and into the 80s, thanks to stagflation. Corporate income had become increasingly important to us. A light bulb went on over my head. Connally got no votes. He picked up one delegate, an older lady from the Deep South. As I recall, he raised $20 million, an unprecedented sum in those days. He was the Pied Piper of the CEOs and the head of FMC and Continental Bank, Quaker Oats. You go on and on and on. And these, in those days, all men, were entranced by Connally. So I thought maybe we can organize a reception. Like the Hebrews after Moses, you know, these guys were wandering, lost in the wilderness. And the George H.W. Bush campaign said yes immediately. Reagan said no, absolutely not. And I was interested to learn at this generally congenial lunch that that was not a staff decision. When I asked former Governor Reagan about this, he said, "Oh, no, Mr. Sir, I'd never do anything like that. You've got to realize that if you want to be president, you've got to convince the average working woman, working man, the person who's struggling to make a living and take care of their family, that you understand their problems, especially if you're a Republican, because we're seen as the party of the rich. And if you do what Connally did and spend all your time in corporate jets and boardrooms and country clubs and, you know, filmed and photographed in that context, they're not going to vote for you." And he said, "Besides, I don't have to cultivate business leaders. They have nowhere else to go. They're quite hostile to President Carter, Ted Kennedy, get serious. So I don't have to cultivate them. I'm hearing from them more and more because I'm winning primaries." It slowly dawned on me that underneath this very friendly exterior, he was an extremely shrewd and crafty politician, far more shrewd than George H.W. Bush, a very smart man who was the dominant figure in this reception we organized for him. But this perception was something quite alien to Bush, and also certainly his son, who just withdrew from the primary race. Politics is a lot more than big money.
Yeah, and the senior Bush 41, just always seemed uncomfortable in his own skin, didn't he, to you?
Well, no, he didn't. I had the chance to be around him face-to-face, in person, in effect. He's one of the most impressive people I've ever met. The same qualities that seemed quite frantic on television were enormously impressive in person. Mm-hmm. Dynamic. He was in a room with 15 or 20 CEOs. And he was the center of gravity, not because he was the presidential candidate, but because he was so smart and such a natural leader. So I would say, no, television is a funny prism. Reagan, who projected enormously effectively when he was younger and also the older phase of his life, which we're discussing, he seemed sometimes pretty bland in person, actually. Television is a curious prism.
I've learned something.
As Richard Nixon could tell us, right?
Absolutely. That voice is Professor Art Sir, which you're familiar with at this hour of the morning. I'm Dave McGrath. Greg Berg is off today. He's a little bit under the weather. Let's move on to current day politics. More presidential primaries today. I know Michigan and Mississippi. Are there more than that?
I don't know. I think there are.
Maybe four altogether.
Yeah.
And to the enjoyment of many, politics and the campaigns and the news, there are people among us, at this point who really couldn't care less because, for example, here in Wisconsin, we don't really have a say in the presidential race until our primary, which is on April 5, I believe, correct?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So we could say anything we want, but nobody really cares. Nobody's listening until April 5th. So I would like to discuss with you then are both the GOP and the Democratic races. But first, what I would love you to do is give us a primer on some terms that are being bandied about a lot lately and terms that we all use in political conversations day to day. Sometimes we don't use them accurately or correctly. Perhaps we're not really clear what they truly mean, or I think to some degree some of those terms may have evolved over the years. And what I'm talking about is socialism, communism, and capitalism. And we'll bring it back around to the presidential campaign, I promise you. So I did ask Art before the show if he would give us a refresher course, and he graciously agreed to. So
we may lose a lot of listeners.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, because I'm guessing Art, maybe not in the erudite company you keep, but you know the people I deal with on a regular basis, I'm not sure we really know exactly what all these terms mean today. Not necessarily what they mean when they respond, but what they mean today. So let's start with communism.
Communism, okay. Karl Marx in the 1800s wrote a large, voluminous collection of works. His most important book is a very long, pretty turgid volume called Capital. He was fascinated by the Industrial Revolution. He believed that the growing concentration of capital, inevitable to capitalism in the modern industrial form, would lead to, he thought, a fairly benign revolution. Like a lot of continental thinkers, continental as opposed to British or American thinkers, I would say, he tended to think and analyze in very abstract terms. He felt that history was a moving force, impersonal in nature, that was moving on inevitably. We tend to be much more individualistic, I think, and much more pragmatic and much more empirical or focusing on the evidence around us. In any case, I don't want to go on for 50 minutes because we don't have that much time left and we would lose all our listeners. But the turmoil and disruption of the Industrial Revolution made this kind of abstract ideology very attractive. Socialism.
Well, let's go back. So communism, essentially, in an economic way, one for all and all for one.
That's the ideal. It emphasized class conflict and class warfare. Marx predicted that the most advanced industrial economies and societies were the most likely to undergo a revolution that would result in benign communism. He was wrong. History proved that point of view wrong. The first communist revolution occurred in Imperial Russia, which was transformed into the Soviet Union and was a terrifying reality for other industrial nations, especially in Europe, especially in Germany.
So in communism, correct me if I'm wrong and elaborate on this, communism, the government owns all manners of production, owns distribution, and runs your life and my life.
Everything except the last point. Capital would become so concentrated that eventually the system could be toppled fairly easily. He didn't foresee, I don't believe, tremendously violent bloodbaths that actually occurred. Again, it would be an advanced industrial economies, and then a very, very benign society would result.
And you've cited already the Soviet Union as communist. Other examples would be Cuba. What other communist countries would you?
Well, China, North Korea, the Red Army imposed communist regimes, basically Soviet satellite states.
So it's taken on a pejorative term.
Yes. Well, for a lot of people, it was pejorative from the beginning. Germany had managed quite brilliantly to knock Russia out of the war by exporting from Switzerland to Russia a very brilliant, very virulent, very dangerous revolutionary by the name of Lenin. He sparked the revolution in Russia. They withdrew from the war. They had a brief democratic regime and then a communist regime. Germany, from the end of World War I, was riven with tremendously violent conflicts, an enormously vigorous and powerful and ruthless communist party. And the specter of communism in the Soviet Union had a great deal to do with the growth of right-wing regimes in Europe and the particularly horrific Nazi regime in Germany. The way communism has affected 20th century history is extraordinarily important. Intellectually, I dare say the ideas are not taken seriously by many people.
But there is always a segment of society that wants to be taken care of, is there not?
Well, that's true. Also, Marx emphasized class conflict and ultimately class warfare, which is what people focus on. He also had an important concept, alienation. Industrial capitalism is so brutal and so taxing and so disruptive that people start to hate the system, hate their jobs, different from a rural society. And regarding alienation, I think Marx was right on, absolutely right. And that helps explain a lot of the most extreme and disturbing political trends in different directions in our country and others.
Let's move on to the socialists.
Okay, but Marx is not to be underestimated. Capital is not something I'd recommend to anyone except the most determined specialist, but it's important to pay attention to Marx because he's had a big impact on history, and like Freud and others, even people who reject very consciously his ideas in more subtle ways, these ideas have had a big effect on our society.
Socialism.
To me, it's more inclusive. You could see communism as a more extreme form of socialism. Again, emphasis on class conflict and traditionally nationalization of industry. Again, during the Industrial Revolution through the 19th century, in the 20th century, if you were a socialist, you really believed in nationalization. Left parties have survived by de-emphasizing that dimension and emphasizing more the welfare state aspects and the reform, especially business and industry reform aspects of socialism. These are big concepts that still have an important effect on our time. Americans have never embraced ideologies, unlike Europeans. And I'm concerned we might have a bit of an academic discussion here because these are terms that don't have a big impact on the reality of our politics and economy.
But we throw them around, so we should know what we're talking about. Capitalism.
Well, fair point. Yep. The Industrial Revolution began in actually the end of the 1600s in Britain with the invention of the steam engine, which was not initially a locomotive, but an engine to remove water, liquid chemicals, human waste from mines in the British Isles. Mining was even more horrible and even more dangerous by far then than now. It was extremely important in the mining industry. It then sparked a tremendous revolution, the Industrial Revolution, and capitalism as a concept, emphasis on the private sector, on the role and allocation of capital, predates the Industrial Revolution, but what we think of as modern capitalism really began in those British mines at the end of the 1600s. A really great writer, a lot more interesting than Karl Marx, Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, which was published, sir, in 1776. I recommend The Wealth of Nations to everybody, and my students and I read and reread parts of it every academic year.
Thank you for those
definitions. Sure, I hope it's clear. I hope it's not too monotonous to people.
I got it. So let's.
You're quite right, because ideas are important, especially today when our crude and vulgar politics is really rejecting ideas. We've never had intellectual politics. That's great. But these terms are important, and we've gone a long way from any kind of serious discussion of ideas.
Well,
so thank you.
In particular, one candidate has really brought that term socialism back into play.
Yeah.
Senator Bernie Sanders, because
right.
He now calls himself, am I right, a democratic socialist?
Yes.
What's that?
It shows how well he believes in the people ruling through orderly elections. He also, I'm not quite sure what it means. It means regulation and breaking up of the big banks, emphasis on the danger of concentrated capital. And he's very big on government spending for welfare purposes. Historically, socialism has had very negative connotations, and communism has had horrible kind for Americans. So it shows really how tolerant we've become that a credible presidential candidate can talk this way. That's to the good. Also, we have great diversity, including an old guy in his mid-70s being a plausible candidate. That shows how much his principal competitor is a woman. And we've got African-American candidates and Latino candidates and other women, and it's great. That's important to keep in mind.
So as long as we brought up Senator Sanders, let's just mention, certainly not in passing, the very formidable Hillary Clinton. That race, obviously, and I don't mean this in any sense of the word other than the basic sense. The real interesting race at this point is on the GOP side. But the other race on the Democratic side with Senator Clinton, Senator Sanders, do you see that? Is there any possible way Senator Sanders can win that nomination? Being realistic.
Always keep in mind I'm a professor, not a politician.
Correct.
Sure there is. She doesn't have a majority of the delegates. It'll be very difficult for him. But part of the genius and fascination of American politics is it is unpredictable. Everybody wrote off Harry Truman, who was a sitting president, mind you, in 1948, and he surprised everyone, even though he was facing a very powerful Southern insurgency. The Southern Democrats walked out of the 48 convention, and a much, much smaller left-wing insurgency by New York and other mostly East Coast liberals. He won. Ronald Reagan was not taken seriously by much of the media before 1980, believe it or not. The media focused on Ted Kennedy and John Connolly until people actually started voting in 1980. So, yeah, former Secretary and Senator Clinton does not have it locked up. I think she will probably get the nomination, but it's extremely helpful, especially in her case, because she's been, in a way, a very sheltered person since 1994. I say that despite the fact that she was elected to the Senate and was in the office of Secretary of State. I think it's really good to have this kind of challenge.
Sure, but to be clear, her campaign certainly is not fraught with peril, is it?
No.
Okay. I believe it was Brett Baer who questioned her yesterday, and I didn't see it. Fox News must have done a town hall with her, and Brett Baer, was questioning her about the email issue that still hangs over her head. As anybody knows, the Republicans and conservatives are keeping that in play, the controversial emails that she's been involved in. She tends to shrug it off. Where's the reality in that, in your mind?
The reality is that if she's indicted, that will be a big problem for her and a huge opportunity for whoever becomes the Republican nominee. In hindsight, where everything is 20/20, doing this for her convenience obviously demonstrates a sense of entitlement that hurts her politically. It was unwise. It hasn't developed any political traction, and so this investigation's been dragging on. We'll see what happens. It's not over yet, but the fact that there hasn't been any big news just leads me to think that she'll survive.
Well, that's intriguing that you say that it hasn't gotten any political traction. So the overall question then to you would be why, and there are people on the right who will tell you because the media is in cahoots with the left.
I think the media today is very diverse. Sure, the center of gravity is on the left and with the Democratic Party among people in the media. It's one reason Fox is a contrary network that I don't think is a source of serious news, nonetheless has done well in the marketplace. I think in many ways it is tougher for Republicans. But that's nothing new. Back in 1960, Richard Nixon, who brooded and resented and focused entirely too much on many challenges and difficulties, real and imagined, he faced some real difficulties. And in fact, I show my students and commend to everybody in our audience the 1960 Kennedy-Nixon debates. I show them a tape of the first one. It's very impressive, but also the obvious bias of the four white males on the news panel and the moderator toward Kennedy, I think, is self-evident. And we don't have that kind of lockstep bias today. I think, especially since Watergate, speaking of Nixon, a lot of reporters, a lot of media people see themselves as there to challenge whoever happens to be the president. Therefore, Carter, far less skillful than Reagan. Actually, Carter, a Democrat, had a much harder time, I think, with the media than Ronald Reagan, the Teflon president.
Let's move over to the right, the GOP race.
Do we have to?
I believe there are four standing. I believe it's Donald Trump, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, and John Kasich. Is that
yes.
Who's left? Let's just the question I want to ask you, and I ask people this all the time, not just brilliant people in academia like yourself, is that race a reflection of our society, our crude, rude, vulgar society in general?
Yes, it is.
Well, that was simple.
I have vivid memories of taking my middle son, mainly, and his buddies, right around the end of the 80s and early 90s, when professional wrestling became mainstream. I would go to the old Rosemont Horizon.
You?
Yeah, sure. Trying to be a good dad. And the adults far outnumbered the children, and it was a very rough audience. And the very popular bar was selling hard liquor at a time when that was becoming not so central to American life, to put it mildly. It was, and it was basically show business. Real wrestling, which I did for a while and throughout college, is a tough sport, as I'm sure you know. But this is show business. And unfortunately, I think the Democrats are to be commended because they've actually talked about policy. I find these Republican debates so vulgar, so crude, and so disturbing. Obviously, I'm getting old. But I find it such an unpleasant experience that I read summaries and look for highlights on the Internet, but I'm not going to watch these atrocities.
So the conventional wisdom is Donald Trump has made the campaign into a reality show, which he's very good at.
Yes, that's right. And reality shows, I mean, there were pitchmen probably forever, but certainly for at least 30 to 35 years. There were classic Hollywood pitchmen and New York ad and promoter types who were trying to get this stuff on the air. And it was rejected by the networks for many, many years. And initially rejected by cable companies because it's garbage. And we do have some responsibility to the public, to ourselves, and back when the FCC was more assertive than today. For more than two decades, this kind of gross and personally insulting and utterly offensive behavior has become mainstream television. So in that sense, you're absolutely right. Yep. You're the brilliant one. You're absolutely right. Donald Trump reflects us. It's just awful in a fundamental sense because this is real power. This is control over the military. This is, at least to a degree, control over a still enormous and satanically destructive nuclear arsenal.
Yeah, from what I've read, because I know nobody in show business, I read that reality shows are just cheaper to produce. You can slap
them
on the air real
quickly.
Well,
you can make money.
Yep.
That's it.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that's the bottom line there.
And that's one of the things in our esoteric discussion of communism, socialism, and Marx. Capitalism has no ethics except for making money.
Bottom line.
It works extremely well, but you do need regulation.
True. As I was reading something yesterday, again, there is a sense in this country that Donald Trump is running away with that GOP nomination.
Mm-hmm.
However, I did read, in spite of all that, he and Ted Cruz are relatively close in delegate counts at this point. And, you know, you hear all the yammer about a brokered convention about Trump not going in with enough votes and they're going to ace him out of the job. He could still lose it. It's his to lose at this point, is it not?
I think that may be an overstatement. He doesn't have it locked up at this point. And I think how Kasich does in Michigan
today.
Yeah, exactly, will be an interesting indicator. The caucus states, especially over the weekend in the Northeast, the Midwest, and the Deep South, Trump did not do very well there. He's expanding participation. It's clear that a lot of people are voting who never took an interest in politics before, which is one reason I brought up, quite rightly, I believe, pro wrestling. But he's also bringing in a lot of people who are more conventional Republicans.
Angry with their party for not doing anything.
Yeah, it's not just pro-Trump people that the numbers are up. The totals remain relatively small, and that's perhaps the most important point. Not that many people vote in primaries. Into the 1970s, we had no more than a dozen primaries. John Kennedy, the hero of the primaries, who emphasized primaries quite rightly and shrewdly in 1960, it was part of his father's and his strategic plan. He entered no more than seven. He took a pass on California. Primaries were by no means pervasive before the 70s, and the fact that not many people vote, relatively speaking, means that those with strong grievances, those who are one-issue people, they tend to dominate primaries. So in many ways, I realize I'm a voice of the past, but the earlier system was a better system. The last time we had candidates who emerged from the convention itself was in 52 with Eisenhower, who was not the front runner, contrary to legend, and Stevenson. And those were two very good candidates, especially from the perspective of today.
Well put.
Well, thank you.
Let's move on.
Please tell me when it's not well put, okay? I don't want to be the last to know.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind. Let's move on to something a little more positive and uplifting, because that presidential campaign is distracting and for a lot of people just real depressing.
And scary when you consider the nature of the office of the presidency of the United States.
It is, but let me just one final thing about that. The Republicans will say, you know what, we made it through 8 years of Obama. And the Democrats say, we made it through 8 years of Bush. We can't make it through 4 years of Trump or Rubio or whoever.
Well, I'm an academic, sir. I'm an expert at predicting the past. And my track record is so poor at this point in my life. I know I've backed so many losers.
Isn't this country just resilient enough to say, all right, if Trump wins 4 years or eight, whatever it is, we'll make it through.
One of my favorite statements attributed apparently falsely to Otto von Bismarck, but he could have said it, is that God takes care of widows, orphans, drunks, fools, madmen, and the United States of America. And our British allies during the darkest days of World War II, you see that sentiment and it's partly resentment of the tremendous resources these Americans have, but also we are sort of the innocents abroad, aren't we?
Yeah. All right. Well, we shall see what we shall see.
Yeah, I think we'll survive. Sure hope so.
All right, yeah. Let's talk about jobs. Job picture. Manpower survey came out. Not rosy, but brighter.
Right.
Brighter picture for Wisconsin and Milwaukee in particular and the rest of the country as far as jobs going. What's causing that turnaround now?
Well, we have a very strong, to put it mildly, enormous and highly productive economy. The gross domestic product of the United States every 20 years since 1940 has approximately doubled. That may slow down by the year 2020 because the total volume has become so gigantic. But we do have a very strong economy, and unless we're in a severe recession, jobs are available. Indeed, I don't want to sound like some preachy professor. Mm-hmm. I'm mindful every day, I assure you, that I'm lucky to have a job and a good one. Jobs are available even in hard times. 20% of all truck maintenance jobs in this immediate Great Lakes area are available at any time. That was true during the 2008-2009 recession. You need computer skills, and those aren't always easy to acquire. It's no longer, as you know, it's being a mechanic is no longer being a guy with an oily rag and a wrench and screwdriver. You need computer skills. Welding jobs are always available. Certain jobs are always available. They can be very unpleasant. Welding is dangerous as well as dirty. But we do live in a very powerful and very rich economy. If you've been out of a job for a while, especially if you're a man or woman who had certain white-collar experience and expectations, it doesn't make life any easier. But the fact that we're having economic growth isn't surprising. We've had relatively slow economic growth since the recovery began in 2009. That's not necessarily bad and makes speculative bubbles less likely. My youngest son was having a challenging illness in 2009. He was doing better. We spent time looking for work, about which he was very diligent, doing it together. And I was impressed at the number of jobs, including especially warehouse jobs, that were available. Personal experience, it wasn't the 30s.
Right. As you know, Art, as you and Greg both know, I'm generally the dumbest guy in any room. True. It's true.
I tell the students, don't put yourself down. Let the other guy put you down because some other guy always will, I assure you.
But here's what it is. I don't have the big picture look. You know, I live my little life.
That's why I'm here, yes.
And I appreciate it. I appreciate your guidance and your patience. But this is how I judge how the country's going. And this may be silly, but I'm not sure it is. Everybody's giving me stuff CVS is forever sending me coupons, 30% off anything you buy. I bought a car. I bought a Ford this last summer, and Ford gave it to me 72 months, 0% interest, no money down. They gave me exactly what I asked for on my trade-in, and I walked away with a beautiful new Ford Escape. Everybody's giving me coupons for 30, 40, 50% off, and to me that says they still need my commerce, and they need it badly. Where am I wrong?
Well, I hope Ford is paying you for these commercials you're delivering on public, on socialist public radio.
Everybody's doing it, too.
Yeah.
Well, all the car dealers are. You know that.
Well, the economy has doubled every 20 years. The current generation of Americans, to put it mildly, is much more comfortable with credit than our predecessors. I almost said predators, perhaps, because we were talking about Wall Street. And that's why. And in an intensely competitive consumer economy, you're going to get offered good deals. You, of course, as a actually sophisticated, shrewd man in the real world, understand that there are scam artists out there, and you can't believe everything you read on the internet or see on the tube.
All right, I'll take that under advice. And
right.
We're running out of time here, and this is Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College. Normally, Greg Berg would be in this seat asking far better and far...
Don't put yourself down.
Yeah, it's true, Art. It's true. Far more well-thought-out questions. I want to talk about the plight of the refugees over in Europe coming out of Syria and all these other places. And I think... You know, I think there are people on both sides of that discussion who make very valid and very cogent points about how many should be let into any country, not just the United States. And now we're starting to see blowback in Germany and some of these other countries that say, thank you, no. And they're having some of these people move back out. When does this end? When can this possibly end, this absolute tsunami of refugees into Europe and to some point other countries?
Well, huge mass movements of displaced people is nothing new. That does, again, like being out of a job, it doesn't help if you're part of that group. The ceasefire in Syria is uneven. I think it's extraordinarily impressive that John Kerry was able to pull this off and that it's working to a degree. If the ceasefire holds, and especially if Russian-American cooperation continues to grow in that part of the world, and I think that's vital for us as well as them, stopping it, that will tend to stop it at the source. The fact that Europeans are letting anybody in, especially the Germans, I think is remarkably impressive. You're right, Chancellor Angela Merkel may not survive, but given history, which everybody's aware of, you don't have to be an historian, the fact that Germany is taking this positive and humane leadership role, I find extraordinarily impressive. There's nothing new about large numbers of refugees in the Middle East. What's new is letting them in, not closing the door. Even the welcoming United States during the Second World War, we quite famously and notoriously turned away Jewish refugees and others. Now, that's a particularly famous case, and we have welcomed refugees, but the relatively open door of the United States is certainly a comparatively recent phenomenon. Since 1965 only, we have generally gone back to our traditional policy of welcoming immigrants from 24 to 65, I can assure you it was very, very hard to get into this country.
I think it was Tip O'Neill, All Politics Local.
Oh, great.
All Politics Local. So I think of this refugee scenario the same way. Now, I understand, so I'm going to be devil's advocate here. The people on the one side of the issue say, well, we understand they're running for, some of them are running for their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them are. We also understand some of those people are very dangerous people. That's on one side. The other side is, you know, we're a big country. We have humongous resources. We're wealthy beyond belief. We can help these people in countries in Europe as well. My question then is, Art Sear, would you take in Syrian refugees to your home?
Actually, you're doing such a good job. I think you should continue to debate with yourself on this. But
Art Sear, would you take Syrian refugees into your home?
I like to think I would.
Art Sear, would you take Syrian refugees into your home?
Yes, of course, if that were necessary.
And
yes,
what would you do to vet them?
Well, I'd rely on the U.S. government to vet people.
Is that a mistake?
No. No, actually, it's very hard for Middle East refugees to get into this country. 90%, they have to wait a long time. 90% of those who apply are turned away. The president makes a very good point in that regard. At the same time, all you need is one who gets through the system who's actually a terrorist. Especially given the temper of the Republican campaign, I think it's important to emphasize that it's remarkable we haven't had a second strike since 2001. It really is truly remarkable. I'm sure there have been many close calls. It's one reason why every president gets gray hair and ages in that job. We're all lucky we don't have to hear about all these things. But it's quite remarkable that we've been able to avoid a second strike since 2001.
But it is a fair argument for people on, again, being devil's advocate, for people on that other side. They say, I understand they're running for their lives, but yeah, I'm not sure about it.
Sure.
What do you say to them? They're not evil people who think that way, are they?
No, it's why public policy is so vitally important, and why voting is so important, and why we need mature adult leaders who actually follow prudent policies. We've had reference to World War II. We're not facing the kind of threat today that was faced then. ISIS is not the second coming of Adolf Hitler. And given the nature of rhetoric, it's extremely important to keep that in mind.
Can I ask you why you say that? Why ISIS is not the second coming of Adolf Hitler? Some people obviously think they are.
They don't have strategic military capacity. They don't have the industrial strength and might of Germany in the 30s. They don't have the very powerful, almost frightening military history and tradition of Germany at that time. And they don't have 80 million dedicated Germans behind them. I could go on. But I don't minimize the threat, but they don't represent a strategic threat to the United States.
Let's move on to one final subject here, a little bit more lighthearted.
That's good.
On NPR the last couple of days here on our Morning Edition program, which we carry here at WGTD, 4 until 8 a.m., they were referring to an interview that was done with Kurt Vonnegut a number of years ago.
Oh, yes.
The great author, writer. And he suggested that perhaps in this country, every president should have a secretary of the future in his cabinet to take a look at the programs that are being considered or implemented in each administration and try to figure out what would happen with that program 20, 25 years down the road, and how would it affect the United States overall. That seems like the most impossible job in the world, but would that be a job you would want, Art?
Sure. Professors are always lecturing everybody and predicting the future with great confidence. Kurt Vonnegut excelled as an author. He was a POW in Germany. I believe he was in the Air Force and shot down during World War II. His greatest novel, most prominent novel, Slaughterhouse-Five, by chance, he and other Allied POWs were imprisoned in an enormous slaughterhouse which could withstand strategic bombing. And he was inspired to follow the career he did, and his personality was defined by the fact that when the Allied raid was over and they went outside, there was nothing left. Devastation and death was everywhere. The men who were in Slaughterhouse 5 were saved, and I think that kind of experience can give you insight into the future. I never doubted that Mr. Vonnegut, unlike some presidential candidates, was a very mature male, a very mature human being.
So when I'm elected king of the world, you join my cabinet?
Absolutely.
Secretary
sure.
of the Future?
Right.
Professor Art Sir, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, thank you again, Art, for your patience with me this morning and for sitting here and answering my questions and joining us as you do every month here on the WGTD Morning Show.
Thanks, Dave. A nice change of pace.
Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street in Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com. We'll be joining Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming here just a minute away at 9 o'clock. Let's update you on the forecast from the National Weather Service. Cloudy, windy, and warm today. 40% chance of rain for the afternoon, a high heading 4. 67 perspective on that number. Normal high this time of year would be 39. The record high was 78 degrees, March 8th, 2000. Tonight, cloudy and warm. Widespread fog, maybe rain, possibly a thunderstorm. Overnight low 52. Wednesday, again, cloudy and warm. 40% chance of rain tomorrow, high of 58. We're at 58 this morning in Racine, Kenosha, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Just about 9 o'clock, this is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio.